From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The Center for Disease Control and the Department of Health and Human Services audits of AIDS service organizations are sending shivers throughout the AIDS activist communities and raising serious concerns about the administration's policies to people living with HIV and AIDS.
Has the Department of Health and Human Services launched a witch hunt against AIDS activist group that sent protesters to the Barcelona AIDS conference and chanted shame, shame as Tommy Thompson tried to give his speech? We go to Washington for the reparations rally that was held this weekend. We'll hear one of the major addresses. And there is a growing movement to vacuum Hoover's name off the FBI building. We'll look at that movement and the man in Boston who's suing the FBI for framing him. He's looking at the relationship between the FBI and the mob. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. An Israeli soldier was killed Tuesday morning near Neve Deklaim settlement in the Gaza Strip. The soldier was seriously injured after being shot in the head. He died of his wounds later. Hamas has claimed responsibility for the killing. Two Israeli Cobra helicopters were dispatched in the direction of Khan Yunis to seek out the attackers. According to Palestinian sources, a 15-year-old Palestinian boy from Khan Yunis was also killed in the gunfight. In the West Bank, Palestinian sources said two Palestinians were killed and at least one injured as Israeli troops entered Tul Karem and took over its refugee camp early this morning. Israeli soldiers were conducting house-to-house searches in the camp, backed up by attack helicopters. A Palestinian man in Tampa, Florida, who co-founded an Islamic research center and charity, will be deported later this week based on secret evidence. He's never been charged with a crime. The Justice Department claims Mazen al-Najjar had ties to terrorists but has never presented proof. He was picked up in 1997 and held for 3 years. After being released in 2000, he was picked up again after September 11th. He has spent 267 days in solitary confinement. The University of South Florida is threatening to fire his brother-in-law, Professor Sami Al-Aryan, as well. Thousands of German soldiers toiled to raise dikes yesterday as floods surged down the Elbe River, and Czech authorities warned of the threat of disease posed by sewage, rubbish, and carcasses left in the water's wake. Facing billions of dollars of damage to crops, homes, and infrastructure, German Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder said tax cuts worth close to $7 billion due to take effect in 2003 will be delayed to help pay for reconstruction. More than 100,000 people have been evacuated in eastern Germany, wide swaths of which have turned into ugly swamp. In the Hungarian capital Budapest, the Danube peaked at 28 feet, but the city appears to have narrowly escaped as the river started to recede. ABC News and CNN reported last night the Bush administration recently considered launching a covert military attack against a small radical Kurdish group in northern Iraq that Washington says might be experimenting with toxic agents. The group is not allied with Saddam Hussein and operates out of the autonomous Kurdish area of northern Iraq. U.S. officials told ABC that members of Ansar al-Islam had been testing primitive forms of ricin and poisonous cyanide gas on farm animals in a makeshift dwelling. Ricin is a derivative of the castor plant bean and is highly toxic to humans. What's interesting is that this group has been highlighted by the Bush administration as being linked to al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, despite the fact it operates in an area of Iraq completely controlled by Kurdish factions and the United Nations. The major Kurdish groups in the area have said Ansar al-Islam is no links to Saddam Hussein, but does contain members of al-Qaeda who fled Afghanistan. News of the potential raid comes amid recent reports that senior Pentagon officials are looking at a variety of covert operations to expand the role of special operations forces in the so-called war on terror. A senior executive at CNN International says U.S. news organizations, quote, censored their coverage of the U.S. campaign in Afghanistan in order to be in step with public opinion in the wake of the September 11th attacks. Rena Golden, the executive vice president and general manager of CNN International, made the remarks at News World Asia, a conference for news executives in Singapore. Golden said, quote, anyone who claims the U.S. media didn't censor itself is kidding you. And she said, this isn't just a CNN issue. Every journalist who is in any way involved in 911 is partly responsible. Senior figures from Afghanistan and Pakistan criticized Western news organizations at the conference, which flooded the region with journalists who were unfamiliar with its politics and history. Friends of the three Fort Bragg soldiers who are suspected of killing their wives this summer say the men exhibited unusual anger and incoherence after returning from Afghanistan, where they were given an anti-malaria drug associated with aggression and mental problems. One of the soldiers was, quote, almost incoherent and visibly shaking while describing marital problems to a neighbor. Another became unable to control his anger at his wife in public, startling those who knew him. A third puzzled his new neighbors with his strange behavior. Soldiers at Fort Bragg told the UPI news agency they're well aware of mental problems linked to the anti-malaria drug Larium, which include aggression, depression, paranoia, hallucinations, and suicidal thinking, even as official military spokesmen dismiss a connection between the drug and the events around Fayetteville this summer, which have drawn national attention. The U.S. Army invented Larium. Over the years, Larium's label, written by manufacturer Hoffman LaRoche and approved by the Food and Drug Administration, has included increasingly troublesome side effects and warns about aggression, paranoia, psychosis, hallucinations, and suicidal thinking. Some patients complain of severe side effects lasting years after they stop taking the drug. Experts on domestic violence say this cluster of killings puzzles them, particularly because so far there's no indication that any of the soldiers had a history of domestic violence. In 80% of the cases, an escalating cycle of violence precedes a killing. Airport security agents will someday be able to read the minds of passengers if a federal government plan succeeds. This according to a report in the Washington Times. NASA's researching how to use non-invasive neuroelectric sensors to monitor signals transmitted from the brains of passengers. The Electronic Privacy Information Center learned of the plan from documents obtained under the Freedom of Information Act. And an Islamic high court in northern Nigeria has rejected an appeal by a single mother sentenced to be stoned to death for having sex outside of marriage. The woman's lawyers said they will appeal to another higher Islamic court. If that fails, they can appeal to the Supreme Court, where the case would force a showdown between Nigeria's constitutional and religious authorities. Chumbawamba, enough is enough. Here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. The Washington Post has reported that the Department of Health and Human Services has begun a review of more than a dozen prominent AIDS service organizations whose members joined in a noisy demonstration against Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson at last month's International AIDS Conference in Barcelona. all of these organizations currently receive government funding. HHS officials said they launched the reviews at the request of 12 members of Congress, who also said they were upset by the absence of religious themes at the meeting. Many of the targeted groups provide services to AIDS patients through government contracts, but they also are vocal activists. Tommy Thompson was heckled on the third day of the week-long conference when he delivered a speech on the U.S. government's overseas AIDS activities. Protesters blew whistles, chanted "shame, shame" rhythmically, jabbed their fingers, and eventually surrounded Thompson on the stage. He read his address to the end, but his remarks were entirely inaudible. Handouts in both English and Spanish criticized the U.S. government for not spending enough on care and treatment of people infected with HIV in poor countries. At the bottom of the flyer was a list of 12 organizations. On July 17th, 5 days after the end of the conference, a letter signed by 12 members of Congress asked Thompson to provide, quote, the total amount of U.S. federal assistance that went to the AIDS conference. The letter also asked how many individuals from both the government and non-government organizations attended the conference with some form of federal assistance. Please provide a complete list of these individuals and their affiliations. We're joined in the studio right now by Ana Oliveira. She is the executive director of Gay Men's Health Crisis. She's also the first woman to run the organization. Welcome to Democracy
Now!
Thank
you.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about what many are perceiving as a crackdown, as retaliation for dissent?
Yes. The administration response to what we believe was a critical act of demonstration of the need for the U.S. government to look at its policies, both domestically and globally, towards HIV and AIDS, is really a response that is sending shivers to all of us and alarming us at potential retaliatory behavior from the government, using access to funding as a threat to the organization. And it is true that throughout the AIDS epidemic, it's an epidemic that has really shown us that care and advocacy go together, that it's not possible to really successfully rally the funds, rally the policies that are needed without being able to speak out. Very early in the beginning of the epidemic, we used to have a very popular slogan called "Silence is Death." And that continues to be very much the case, particularly now as the pandemic and the epidemic in the U.S. has so much expanded to very vulnerable populations that require much more care, that require fundamental, very long existing issues related to poverty, to racism, and to gender discrimination issues to be addressed.
Were you at the Barcelona conference?
Yes, I'm one of the persons that probably will be listed there, and with my affiliation, absolutely. GMHC, actually as part of our mission, is a very important role of advocacy. And what happened is that we wanted to put in the world stage the fact that the U.S. has not resolved its issues, and has not resolved its issues internally, and it has not taken up its leadership in the global pandemic as it can, as the richest country. The country with an enormous amount of influence in a variety of international bodies that determine the economic fate and access to health care and infrastructure and medications in almost the rest of the poorer nations. This country really has a tremendous responsibility to respond with the urgency that is needed.
So were you one of those who stood and
yes,
said, shame,
yes,
shame?
Yes.
Had you met with Tommy Thompson?
Not before that. We met with the secretary subsequent to that. We had a brief meeting, and we were able to, again, raise the issues that we were raising, which had to do with very limited financial contribution to the global fund, with here nationally, flat funding for critical programs for access to care. I mean, this year alone, we're facing between 10 and 15,000 persons not being able to access a medication entitlement program called ADAP because of flat funding in the federal government. We're also facing prevention programs being molded or asked to be molded to one approach called abstinence only for prevention. In the federal budget, the prevention funding was flat for all programs except for programs that approach prevention from an abstinence only model. They had a 30% increase. And the federal government continues to ban funding for needle exchange programs, which all of those issues have been scientifically demonstrated to be very effective.
Explain what you mean by needle exchange programs.
Needle exchange programs, there are studies that have demonstrated that intravenous drug users, when they have access to clean needles every time they use, that it reduces the transmission of HIV through the syringe, through the sharing of syringes. And these programs are very popular in Europe. These programs exist in different countries in Latin America. These programs have been demonstrated here in the U.S. to be very effective in reducing the transmission through needle sharing and the blood contamination of HIV and AIDS. Mm-hmm. Yet, the federal government does not approve funding for any of these programs.
What is Thompson's history? Where does he stand on these issues?
He, during the meeting that we had, we were actually kind of heartened. We raised the same issues that we had raised publicly earlier in the in his presentation and in demonstration, and he told us that he would look into several of these issues. And our main request was also to continue a dialogue with the federal government, to have access to meetings, because part of what also the AIDS epidemic has told us is that it's really important for the government to ground its policies in the real needs of those most vulnerable in the epidemic. And that's what activists are doing. You know, we're speaking in that regard.
We're speaking with Ana Oliveira, who is the head of Gay Men's Health Crisis, one of the groups that was involved in the protests in Barcelona, but also that receives federal funding and was named specifically in a letter by Congress members, 12 members of Congress, that asked the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services, Tommy Thompson, to provide the total amount of U.S. federal assistance that went to the AIDS conference, and asked for how many individuals attended the conference with some form of federal assistance. It also named the groups AIDS Project Los Angeles, AIDS Vaccine Advocacy Coalition, and Treatment Action Group. Among the Congress members that sent this letter were Indiana Republican Mark Sauder, Roland Foster, a staff member for the House Government Reform Subcommittee on Criminal Justice, Drug Policy, and Human Resources, which Sauder chairs, sent an email message to someone in HHS's Legislative Affairs Office that said, "Can you determine the current federal funding levels, if any, received by the following organizations," naming all of those groups? 6 days later, Foster sent another message expanding the list to 16 AIDS community groups, yet they insist that this is not a witch hunt, that this is not Secretary Thompson's style.
Well, it's. I think we've learned that coincidences are not to be dismissed. And in this case, the timing of the letter, the specific reference to the conference, we have two concerns. One is that the audits will provide opportunity for arbitrary enforcements, administrative enforcements, and potential intimidation of the agencies. The other is that just the fact that organizations know that others are about to be audited, and some are actually being audited already, it sends a chilling effect. People start to self-censoring. People start to stop taking the risks that are necessary to provide care and to do prevention in the epidemic.
At the same time that this is happening, last week, you and other leaders of AIDS organizations held a news conference in New York City to respond to a report released by the United Way of New York City that talked about the crisis, the epidemic of AIDS, particularly in low-income communities. Now, this is a national program, but in New York City, what are the communities that are hardest hit, and who are the people?
Absolutely. I think that it's so important that there's two critical points in the United Way report. One is that poverty and HIV and AIDS in the epidemic are intrinsically connected. That AIDS, the AIDS epidemic, has become part of the living conditions of poor people in the city. The epidemic has never left its original communities. There were gay communities, there was kind of the tip of the iceberg in the early 80s, but it certainly has expanded. And now it is very much related with all the other indicators of poverty, homelessness, lack of education to health, to access to education, to health care, etc. The conditions for women and women in childbearing ages without support to maintain their families. I would say that the impact of the welfare reform and the limits in welfare access to public benefits are really very damaging to the vulnerability of women and poor people to situations of dependency, to situations of more risk in their lives. So the report, if you look at the impact of the report telling us that the poorer areas of New York City show the highest rates of HIV infection, and then you look at the less funding from the government, and you look at more censorship, and you look at more intimidation. It's really a confluence of facts that is not coincidental and that we can't accept and not make the link.
A simple fact, HIV/AIDS is the leading cause of death in women ages 25 to 34. Second leading cause of death for women ages 35 to 44 in New York City, affecting primarily women of color. At least half of all those who are newly infected are under the age of 25.
Yes, and it's within poor communities. Poor communities of color bear an enormous brunt of the epidemic. And evidently, for women of color, they bear about 87% of all cases of women living with HIV and AIDS in the city.
Is the reason that there's much less attention paid to AIDS in this country that it used to be seen or as a disease of more affluent gay white men? Is it fair to say the rates are going down in that community? And so the news coverage is going down?
Well, I think that actually the rates did go down in the white gay communities of more middle class standing. They did go down for a while. We're seeing a resurgence in young gay men again, in young white gay men as well. But parallel to that, I think that what has happened is in the mid-90s, we've had wonderful developments from the medical point of view, with complicated medications at the time that have become much simpler, and they really prolong the lives and improve the lives of people living with HIV and AIDS. So on the one hand, it becomes harder to call attention to something where people are not walking down the street looking so sick and dying so fast. Yes. On the other hand, it is also, I think, we have, this is not the only disease, it's not the only condition, that once it impacts populations that have less access to power directly, it becomes part of what's, so to speak, acceptable. It becomes part of what becomes the conditions of poor and fragile communities. And what we're seeing here is a need to, one, call the attention to dealing with the issues of poverty, the issues of racism, the issues of sexual inequalities in order to address the epidemic. And at the same time, saying that some of the stigma, because this is really the case, some of the stigma of the original populations identified with HIV, which is really gay men. So the fear of homophobia has really prevented and really made it very difficult for people who are living with HIV and AIDS to also be upfront about it and direct about it and access care without prejudice.
Ana Olivero, and thank you very much for being with us. Executive Director of the Gay Men's Health Crisis. Thank you. You're listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to Boston, find out about a man who's just come out of prison after 3 decades, charged, convicted of murder. He and 3 other men, 2 of them died in prison. They've come out and they are charging that the FBI knew full well who had committed the murder, that it wasn't them, but that that man was a high-level FBI informant and that J. Edgar Hoover didn't want to compromise his sources. We'll find out more in a minute.
Land, they called it evidence. They took away my Birkenstocks, they took away my car. But when they took my fiddle, well, you know they went too far. The FBI stole my fiddle.
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 William Sessions stole my fiddle. And I want my fiddle back. They said my strings was fuses, my bow it was a light. Down inside my fiddle hole, I stash my dynamite. So when I stroke my fuse strings with my fiddle bow, you better run for cover, cause this fiddle might just blow. The FBI stole my fiddle.
The FBI stole my fiddle.
The FBI stole my fiddle.
Stole my fiddle.
J. Edgar Hoover stole my fiddle. Agent Richard Held is the man behind
the late Judy Barry, who just won a major case, at least her estate, against the FBI. This is an old recorded tune of hers, "The FBI Stole My Fiddle." I am Amy Goodman. As Attorney General John Ashcroft tries to expand the FBI's power in the so-called war on terror, the FBI has come under fire for framing innocent civilians in the 1960s. Last week, the Bureau was sued for $300 million for knowingly allowing an innocent man to be sentenced to death. This is not because of COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program against the American Indian Movement or the Black Panthers, but because of FBI involvement in the Boston mob underworld. The case revolves around a man nicknamed the Animal, a man who is considered the most dangerous individual known in New England. Joseph Barboza was also an FBI informant, approved by J. Edgar Hoover himself. Government records show that at a 1968 trial, the FBI withheld evidence in order to shield Barboza's identity. As a result, four innocent men were sentenced to death. The sentences were later reduced to life, but two of the men, Henry Tamaleo and Louis Greco, have died in prison. Peter Lamone served 34 years, and Salvati served 30 years. Salvati is now suing the FBI for hundreds of millions of dollars. Congressional leaders have strongly condemned the FBI's role. Right-wing Republican Dan Burton of the House Committee on Government Reform recently introduced legislation to strip J. Edgar Hoover's name off the FBI building in Washington. He has bipartisan support. But Attorney General John Ashcroft has publicly praised the Justice Department's unorthodox investigative methods in the 60s to crack down on the mob underworld. Ashcroft said in October, investigators focused on function, not form. They focused on doing what was necessary to get the job done rather than what was dictated by the organizational chart. Well, to fight the so-called war on terror, Ashcroft has sought to restore the FBI's ability to conduct domestic surveillance and to enhance its investigative powers. We turn right now to Ralph Ranalli. He's a reporter for the Boston Globe and author of Deadly Alliance. It's the only book on the FBI program set up to employ organized crime figures as government informants. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks.
Can you bring us to the beginning of this story and what this lawsuit is all about?
Well, the story has its beginnings back in the 1950s, and it's an amazing story of what happened to Joe Salvati and Henry Tamaleo and Peter Lamone, but it's even more disturbing and amazing if you look at the root causes, and it's really a story of kind of how government involves itself in evil and how this, you know, sort of takes place. And what happened was is that in the 1950s, it was becoming increasingly clear to the American public and to a lot of people in government that organized crime in the United States, particularly Italian organized crime, was a major problem. There were large Italian organized crime groups. They controlled a lot of money and a lot of politicians, and they had a lot of power. But the FBI was very sort of curiously on the sidelines, and it was because J. Edgar Hoover was sort of afraid of going after the FBI. He didn't want his agents to potentially be corrupted so that, you know, and to damage the public image of the agency, because, you know, image was everything to Hoover and the FBI. And he didn't like organized crime cases because they took a lot of manpower and with relatively few results. And Hoover was really interested in empire building, going up to Capitol Hill with gaudy statistics and saying, look, you know, we've solved all these crimes, give me more money, give me more agents, give me more laws to enforce. So Hoover basically said there was no such thing as the mafia. Well, a couple of things happened in the early 1960s, the late 50s and early 60s. One was the New York State Police just sort of happened accidentally upon this major convocation in upstate New York called the Appalachian Conference, because it was in a small town called Appalachian, New York, where all these mobsters from all over the country were having this big meeting at a farm owned by one of these guys from New York. Well, that was one piece of conclusive proof that there was this large national mafia conspiracy out there, despite what Hoover said. In the early 1960s, Bobby Kennedy, who was the Attorney General, put a guy named Joe Valachi on national television. Valachi was the first major mafia turncoat and was the guy who went on national TV and told all these stories that, you know, most people know now associate with the Godfather story. The whole thing about the code of silence and how you're initiated into the mafia, you know, all these sort of pieces of mafia lore. And so after Valachi, it was incredibly obvious to the entire country that Hoover was wrong. There was an FBI, and why wasn't there was a mafia, and why wasn't the FBI, you know, trying to combat it? Well, of course, you know, Hoover had to get the FBI into the game. And the top echelon informant program, which is really what this story is about and it's what my book is about, was the result of that. Basically, it was a shortcut to get the FBI into the war on the mafia because by any means necessary, because Hoover was embarrassed. And so within a couple years, lo and behold, what did you have in Boston? They made cases all over the country. They used illegal wiretaps, some of the same tactics they used against the Communist Party of the United States and against, you know, other so-called radical groups. They basically borrowed those tactics wholesale and applied them towards the mafia in the early 60s. And lo and behold, magically, you had these three cases against three major mob guys in New England. You had a case against Raymond Patriarca, the mob boss. You had a case against Jerry Angiulo, the mob boss in Boston. And then the third in command was Henry Tamelio, who was in the same case with Joe Salvati. Joe Salvati was actually a small fish in that case. But all those cases were built on the word of this informant, cooperating witness named Joe Barboza, Joe the Animal, who was admitted himself to killing at least 26 people. So, and that's what this story is about. It's really about the FBI driven by publicity and careerism and you know, its sort of disregard for the Constitution and willingness to take shortcuts, rushing headlong into the war on the mafia, using any means necessary, and just squashing anyone who got in its way. And it turns out that now we see these documents that show conclusively that the case against Salvati and Lamoni was a big lie. The case had nothing, the murder that they were convicted of had nothing to do with the mafia. So that's really what my book Deadly Alliance is about. It's about this, how this evil sort of, the circumstances around it sort of built up, and the way Hoover's methodology sort of met this set of circumstances, and this really horrible, evil thing resulted.
So what happened to these men in prison?
Well, they basically just rotted there. They sat there for 30 years and went through appeal after appeal after appeal, saying, oh, we didn't do it. We think these other guys do it. And there was like small pieces of evidence lying around that maybe suggested that they might not have done it. But the whole time, sitting in the FBI files, were these truly horrific documents. It's hard to be horrified by a document. It's hard to be horrified by a document, but it's amazing. The documents in this case show three things. One, they show the FBI knew that Joe Salvati and Peter Lamoni were innocent. They showed the FBI knew that somebody else did it. But they showed two other things that I think are maybe even worse, if that's possible. One, they showed that not only did the FBI know that other guys committed this murder, they knew that other guys were going to commit the murder before it happened, and they didn't do anything to stop it. So, I mean, Joe Salvati and Peter Lamoni spent 30 years in prison, but Teddy Deegan, the small-time hoodlum who died, and you know it was murder the case was about his murder. He never had to have died. The FBI could have stepped in and stopped it, but instead they played God and they didn't stop it. And the other thing was that the documents show why they didn't do that. It's because they were cultivating a friend of Joe Barboza, the witness, to be an undercover, a deep cover informant, a guy named Jimmy the Bear Fleming, who was Joe Barboza's best friend. So they were courting this guy, Jimmy the Bear Fleming, And you see them, the agents and the superiors in D.C., talking back and forth about who he is. And they, the agents in Boston tell the superiors in Washington that Jimmy the Bear is a notorious hitman and a killer, and he's admitted that he wants to become the biggest killer in the history of Boston. And then you see these horrible memos come back that say, you expect and hope the FBI superiors are saying, no, we don't want to touch this guy. We don't want to get anywhere near him. Instead, they say, you know, they give him the big thumbs up. They say, he seems like an excellent candidate. And that's what the top echelon informant program was all about. It was all about throwing the rules and morality out the window and going after these, you know, horrible killers and serial murderers and psychopaths, because that's where the inside information about the mafia was, and it was the easiest way to get it, by cutting a deal with these guys, because these guys needed protection from the FBI more than anybody.
I'm looking at the quote of Joe Salvati's attorney, Victor Garrow, who told the Boston Herald that he drew the $300 million figure, that's the amount that Salvati is suing the government for, from the amount in punitive damages the Iranian government was ordered to pay journalist Terry Anderson, the former AP correspondent held hostage for more than 6 years. A federal judge ordered the Islamic Republic of Iran to pay Anderson a total of $341.7 million. Salvati's attorney Garrow said the Salvati case is worse than the Anderson case because this was done by our own government to our own citizen.
I think they have a good point. I mean, and you have to sort of, I mean, some people might think, you know, what does an Iranian hostage have to do with the guy who was wrongfully imprisoned in the United States? But, you know, the hard, tough question for Victor Garrow is, how do you put a price on, you know, the majority, in all probability, of a man's life, you know, thrown down the toilet? And that's, I think, as good a figure as any. I mean, and he does have a point. I mean, this wasn't geopolitics, you know, coming into play here. This was about, you know, bureaucracy and greed and, you know, sort of careerism and all these horrible, petty little things that added up to this great, awful, evil program that the FBI kept secret for 30 years. And I think that they have, you know, whether they're going to get $300 million, I mean, it's a lot easier for a jury to dun the Iranian government for $300 million than it is for a jury to essentially dun the U.S. government for that amount of money, because, you know, deep down, I think they know they're all taxpayers. But I think in the final analysis, anyway, slice it, the government and, by extension, you know, we as taxpayers are going to pay dearly for this FBI program. Salvati's suing for $300+ million, but there are multiple victims, some people who were murdered by the informants who were part of this program. That's the other half of the story in Boston and elsewhere. There were these guys, informants, these top echelon informants in New York and Cleveland and all around the country, Miami. And the victims are starting to come out of the woodwork now, and they're starting to sue. And with the $300 million Salvati suit, the total amount of claims against the government based on people who were victimized by this top echelon informant program is now about $1.8 billion. So Salvati is not the majority of the claim.
What about these other cases? Can you go into one?
Oh, sure. There was a guy named Roger Wheeler. He was a businessman in Tulsa, Oklahoma, a guy who was sort of on the cutting edge of the first, you know, he was on the riding the first wave of the computer technology boom back in the late 70s and early 80s. I mean, this is a guy who had the potential to be a Bill Gates or another sort of, you know, titan of the high tech in the 80s and 90s. Well, he had some extra cash from a sale of a business, and he invested it in a small gambling company in Miami called World High Lie. High Lie is this game that's played sort of kind of like racquetball, but you can actually bet on the outcome in these little stadiums called frontons.
We only have a minute.
Well, unbeknownst to him, the two top echelon informants had their hooks into this game, and when he got too close, he had them, these two informants, Whitey Bulger and Steve Fleming in Boston, had Wheeler killed. And the FBI, there are documents that show that the FBI covered up Wheeler's murder and blocked the investigation of Wheeler's murder to protect these two other informants. So now his family is suing for over $800 million, saying that this guy, you know, would have been the next Bill Gates, and they appear to have a case.
So Congressmember Dan Burton, well known for his extremely conservative views, is joining other more liberal Congress members in calling for Hoover's name to be vacuumed off the FBI building?
Yeah, that's. I think it's a bit of symbolism that, you know, Burton doesn't really expect it to actually happen. But it's his way. It's Burton's way of saying, this is how deep my outrage over this goes. Because the more you look at these documents, it doesn't really matter what your political stripe is. I think the more, just as a human being, it's almost impossible not to be horrified if you look at this stuff and truly see, you know, what went on. I mean, if you want to read more, you know, there's a ton of them in my book, Deadly Alliance.
Well, on that note, Ralph Ranelli, I want to thank you for being with us, reporter for the Boston Globe, author of Deadly Alliance, the only book on the FBI program set up to employ organized crime figures as government informants. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, the reparations rally in Washington. Stay with us.
All right. Slip, you might slide, you might stumble and fall by the roadside, but don't you ever let nobody drag your spirit down. Yeah, we're walking up to heaven, my brother, don't let nobody turn you around. Walk with the rich, walk with the poor, learn from each other, that's what love is for. Don't you let
nobody drag your spirit down.
Tag your spirit
let
down.
Let nobody drag your spirit down.
Don't let nobody drag your spirit down. Eric Bibb here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to the rally for reparations in Washington, D.C., as thousands gathered on the 115th birthday of Marcus Garvey to demand reparations for the U.S. government for centuries of slavery and oppression. This is the Reverend Herbert Daughtry, who is pastor of the House of the Lord Church in Brooklyn, New York, and one of the organizers of this weekend's rally.
We have come here on this Marcus Messiah Garvey's 115th birthday, the greatest organizer who told us to look for him in the whirlwind. So we look for Garvey in every whirlwind of social change. We look for him here today. I fancy I hear him challenging us, up, you mighty race, you can accomplish what you will. So we have come here today not to cash a check, but to demand one. The check to which Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. referred almost 40 summers ago in this very city was never honored by the rulers of America. The check came back then and it comes back today, insufficient funds. His check demanded riches of freedom. The check we demand includes freedom, justice, and equality. But in addition, the check we demand requires payment for 400 years of unrequited labor. 400 years of toiling in the most oppressive condition, producing the wealth enjoyed by Euro-Americans from that time up to the present. 400 years of unprecedented devastation of a people and a continent. 400 years of slavery, colonization, segregation, discrimination, and every kind of dehumanizing system conceived by demonic forces in human flesh. 400 years of stealing and cheating and swindling and exploiting. 400 years of raping and ravishing, bombings and lynchings, such as no people have ever experienced. for no reason at all. Fred Douglas said in his 4th of July speech in the 1800s, describing the unspeakable horrors of America's treatment of African people, he said, "Go where you may, search where you will, go to South America, travel to the old world, search out every abuse, and when you have found the last, place them beside the everyday practices of the people of this country. And I'm sure you will agree with me that for shameful hypocrisy and revolting barbarism, America reigns without a rival." Yes, let us not forget, they owe us for loyalty too. We have shed our blood in every war this country ever had. We were there in the Revolutionary War. Crispus Attucks was the first to die. We were at Bunker Hill and we were at Valley Forge with Washington. Had we not been there, there wouldn't be a United States of America. We were there too when the Union forces marched against the Confederacy. Had it not been for black soldiers in the struggle to survive this Union, there would be no Union. And Abraham Lincoln said as much. Now I know that there are those who say slavery ended in 1865. Nay, but the evils inherent in the slave system did not suddenly stop with the Emancipation Proclamation of 1863 or with the Union victories in 1865, nor with the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment to the Constitution. Nay, but the legacy continues even to the present time. Indeed, the beat goes on. Immediately following 1865, a wave of terror swept across America like a prairie fire, consuming blacks by the thousands in the most agonizing forms of death. I know that there are those who are experiencing fear today as a result of September the 11th. Well, I just want to say to you, welcome to Black America. Living with terror, we have lived with terror for so long that we have normalized it. In fact, we have lived with it so long that we can even celebrate it. We just survive anyhow, progress anyhow, no matter what you do to us. Yes, from the black codes of 1865 and 1867, which attempted to diminish and to destroy our people, to the most recent racist attack, we have been subjected to terror such as no other people. Emory University said that from 1882 to 1930, over 5,000 of our people were reported, notice, reported lynched. Reported, there's no telling how many others were lynched and unreported. Ida B. Wells stated at the turn of the century that from 1865 to 1995, over 10,000 of our people were brutally destroyed, brutally killed, and that is the reported amount. No, slavery did not end. The legacy of slavery did not end with the war of 1865. Not only so, but they have stole our land. They have subjected us to peonage and sharecropping. Not only so, but we have been subjected to discrimination up to the present time. The recent statistics say in the American businesses, 1/3 of the American businesses still practice discrimination. And do you know what, brothers and sisters, listen and listen well. Isn't it ironic, incredibly ironic, that the most violent, the most vicious acts have emanated from the police department, from the people we pay to protect us, the people we pay to protect us and from whom we need to be protected? No, no, indeed, the legacy of slavery did not end, and it is very much with us today. I know that there are those who said, but I didn't do anything, as Councilman Charles Barron indicated. Yeah, but you are the beneficiaries of what your ancestors did. The very fact that you have a pale face means that you'll live from 6 to 8 years longer than me because I have a dark face. The very fact that a white sister or a pale-faced sister will live 8 to 10 years longer than a sister with a dark face because you have membership in the club. You are the beneficiaries of what other people have done. If you don't believe that you're linked to the past, then why don't you get amnesia? If you don't believe you're linked to the past, why don't all of you who have inherited anything from your ancestors give it back? The reality is we are linked to the past. And for pale-faced folk, you don't have to do anything. You simply reap the benefit of what your ancestors did. I know there are those who say, yes, but what do you want? As Brother Charles Barron has indicated, we want you to pay up. It is morally right, legally just, and historically valid. Paying reparation is as ancient as the scripture. The Bible says when the thief is caught, he ought to repay sevenfold. Yes, reparation is as old as the Bible, and it is as recent as Queen Mother Moore. It is as recent as H.R. 40, which was put in place by Congressman John Conyers. But if you want to go back, General Sherman in 1865 issued Field Order 15, which broke up the plantations and gave the freedmen a piece of the land. You can go back to the Freedmen's Bureau and go back to one of my favorite churchmen, Bishop MacNeil Turner, who in 1890 had calculated how much they owe us. Yes, reparation is due us. It is right. It is moral. It is legal. And we have come to say, give us the check. Now, I know that those who say, well, all I want is my personal check. I hope you get your personal check. That's why I said to people who get welfare checks, listen, don't hang your head because you got a welfare check. Child, get the welfare check. Hold your head up high, because I don't care how many welfare checks you get. They will not have paid you for the labor of your ancestors. Just don't get a welfare mentality while you're getting the check. What do we want? Well, we want reparation, and we want it now. Now, you may want a check. I'm not sure. Somebody has said if we get a check, General Motors will be at our door tomorrow with a brand new Cadillac with all kind of chrome on it, black and green flags all around it. We'd be broke in about a year from now. No, reparations would mean rebuilding our cities. The Marshall Plan, as they rebuilt Western Europe, a Marshall Plan would mean a massive health program. We suffer from more disease than any other people in this country. We have an epidemic in health. We need an educational program. Yes, we need our land back. The land that they've stolen, the land that they've taken, the land that they've, through thievery and manipulation, took from our people. We want the land back. That's just a start. I would be all for cancellation of third world debts. We don't want to pay you back anything. If anything, pay back. Pay back the countries of Africa. Pay back the countries of the Caribbean. Pay them back. They don't owe you anything. If it were not for the labor of our mothers and fathers, there'd be no wealth in the United States. If there were not for the labor of our mothers and fathers, there would be no Washington Monument putting his fingers to the sky, having stolen a design from Egypt. Not only were we subjected to violence after the Civil War, but let me tell you something else. These thieves went after our genius. They stole our music. They stole our art. They stole the stuff of which the spirit is made. They stole everything that we had. So because of the violence, because of the labor, because of the toil, because of the violence. They owe us, and we should not rest. We should not rest. We should not slumber. We should not sleep. We should not get weary until justice is done and reparation is a reality in this country. Let me conclude on this note. Somebody said, well, what y'all going to Washington for? You ain't gonna get nothing. What are you expending all this energy for? You ain't gonna get nothing. Well, I tell you something I've learned a long time ago. In a struggle, you define what winning is. And the very fact that I look across this massive, massive audience today, I declare to the world, we're winning. When I think about people's consciousness being raised, I declare we are winning. When I put the enemy on the defensive and take the offense with a moral argument, I say we are winning. And we're going to keep on winning. We're not going to stop. We're not going to quit. We're not going to give up. You can bomb us, lynch us, put the police on us, send the FBI after, send the Air Force if you want to, send the Navy. But when it's all over, I said, when it's all over, I said, when it's all over, we'll still be here as our mothers and fathers were a long time ago. We'll still be here as was Denmark Vesey. We'll still be here as was Malcolm X. We'll still be here as was Marcus Garvey. We'll still be here as was Patrice Lumumba. We'll still be here as Shaka of the Zulus. We'll still be here as the Mau Maus and the Maroons. We'll still be here fighting still, because we know ultimately we're going to win. We're going to win. We're going to win. God bless you.
The Reverend Herbert Daughtry of House of the Lord Church in Brooklyn, New York, one of the organizers of this weekend's Millions for Reparations March in Washington, D.C. And that does it for the program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Jeremy Scahill, Mike Burke. The speech was recorded by Orlando Richards. You're listening to Democracy Now! Our website is www.democracynow.org. You can email us at mail@democracynow.org. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. For another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
We're living in a mean time and an aggressive time, a painful time, a time where cynicism rots the vine, and a time where violence blocks the sunshine. Lifetimes go by in a flash, in a search for love, in a search for cash. Everybody wanna be some fat tycoon, everybody wanna be on a tropic honeymoon. Nobody wanna sing a little bit out of tune, or be the backbone of a rebel platoon. It's too soon to step out of line. You might get laughed at, you might get fined, but do you fear me when I say I feel pain every day when I see the way my friends gotta slave and never get ahead of bills they gotta pay? No way, no way. Some make a living doing killing, Colombian penicillin. Some are willing to play the villain, they just chilling to pass the time, pass the information, or pass the wine, pass the buck, or pass the baton. But you can't pass the police or the Pentagon, the IRS or the upper echelon. I think it's time to make a move on the contradiction. Bomb, bomb, rock the nation, take over television and radio station. Bomb, bomb, the truth shall come, give the corporations a complication. Bomb, bomb, rock the nation, take over television and radio station. Bomb, bomb, the truth shall come, give the corporations a complication. Say, ooh, ooh. Of our time, I say it one more time to emphasize the meaning of my rhyme, to rise above all the dirt and grime at the right spice at the right time. The Constitution, are we part of the solution or are we part of the pollution? Sitting by and wondering why things ain't the way we like to find them to be for you and for me, the people over there and the ones in between. Check our habitation, are we a peace-loving nation? Peace-loving nation. I have a reasonable doubt, I think I dispel it out. There's no need to scream or to shout, then
IRA just bought a man's soul. Then he jumps up and shouts, gun control. The government say that killing's a sin unless you kill a murderer with a lethal syringe. So I